cold in here. While you're setting up housekeeping, each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes goes to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. A reminder to pay attention to the time limits. Also, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. The podium has been raised and lowered several times today, so just find your own comfort level and before you begin your remarks. With that said, I'll ask our marshal to call the last case for court consideration.
Now hearing case number A230271, State of Minnesota versus Brown.
Okay. All right, good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name's Sarah Eitnauer. I'm an attorney at the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Henry Lee Brown. Mr. Brown asks this court to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea and alternatively to reverse the district court's denial of his motion for a departure. I want to first focus on the second issue today, why the plea is constitutionally invalid. An element of criminal vehicular homicide is operating a motor vehicle. The definition of operating includes an act. A person cannot act volitionally while his head is bobbing up and down, while he is unconscious, and while he's suffering a seizure. The record here, however, must establish that Mr. Brown pleaded guilty to an offense at least as serious as that he could have been convicted at trial. And the record does not do that, because the record does not establish that he was volitionally acting at the time of the collision. The statute in the jig provide elements of the offense. These elements include causing the death of a human being as a result of operating a motor vehicle, where the driver causes the collision and leaves the scene of the collision in violation of 169.09 subdivision 1 or 6. Here, the record for the guilty plea did not establish that Mr. Brown was operating the vehicle.
Well, let me ask, did he admit to driving the car during the plea hearing?
I think he admitted to being in the driver's seat of the car, but it did not establish that he was operating because it did not establish that he was committing any volitional act causing the motor vehicle to function. Under the jig actually defines it as performing an act that causes the vehicle to function or controls the functioning of the motor vehicle.
So just like taking the legal part of your argument and bringing it into a district court courtroom when a defendant has made the decision to enter a guilty plea to this offense, what exactly would the admission have to be, to ensure that the plea was accurate to this particular offense? What would the admission be?
Sure, and I think just jumping to what's missing here, the defendant would have to admit that he was operating the vehicle, that he was doing an act that caused...
He was in the driver's seat.
Correct.
And he said that he caused the collision with, I believe his name is Johnson. Isn't that driving a motor vehicle? You're in the driver's seat and you have a collision.
Your Honor, that's not enough under the definition of operating. Under
missing.
He's not committing a volitional act causing the motor vehicle to function. Simply sitting in the driver's seat is not causing the motor vehicle to function. In fact, there's an argument under Henderson that the passenger can be operating a motor vehicle. The passenger is not sitting in the driver's seat.
Afterwards, he said he continued driving the vehicle. Continued driving. So I'm not following what your argument is.
Sure. And Your Honor, I think part of the problem with that is he didn't actually have a recollection of that, and that also was established at the plea hearing. His
if he was trying to tender a Norgaard plea, and his attorney said no.
Correct. He was. That's what the court thought that this started to look like a Norgaard plea because Mr. Brown maintained that he didn't remember what happened.
Counsel, wasn't the position of the parties at that time, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that what he's pleading guilty to basically is the fact that once the lady let him know what had happened and he knew what had happened, he had a duty to go back to the scene immediately. And not only did he not go back immediately, he didn't go back even the next day. And that's kind of what they were focused on when they were talking about this really isn't a Norgard issue because he was advised of this and he failed to go back. And I understand what you're saying, that somehow they missed the idea that despite all that, he actually had to be in some kind of conscious operation of the vehicle at the time. And it seems like to me then that your argument kind of is the one where somebody's driving and the passenger gets mad at him and grabs a steering wheel and steers into the other lane of traffic. They're not operating at that moment. And in this case, if he was having a seizure, perhaps he was not capable of operating or driving at the moment that he collided with this man. But how important is that where the real issue is, once he found out what happened, he didn't go back and talk to the police?
Your Honor, that's extremely important because a plea, to be constitutionally valid, each element of the offense must be established on the record. And one of the elements is the leaving the scene and not going back. But another one of the elements is operating the motor vehicle. And the record, it seems maybe they overlooked it, but the record does not establish that he was operating the vehicle because he wasn't acting volitionally. And act has been defined by this court. It's been defined in the JIG. You know, in Henderson, that's the case with the passenger grabbing the wheel. The Supreme Court defined that as any act that causes a vehicle to function and controls the functioning, again, mirroring the JIG. And
so to go back to the courtroom scenario, you know, where you've got the parties, you've got the judge, the defendant is entering this plea. We want to make sure every element of the offense is covered. Under your argument, is it enough for the defendant to say, yes, I was driving at the time of the incident?
I'm not sure that it would be enough necessarily. And in this case specifically, it's not enough because we have so many other statements that negate that element. We have the primary witness in her statement that was submitted to bolster the plea, saying that, I think she said, his head was bobbing up and down. She later talks about when he came to, she tried to wake him up.
That's evidence that's could have been raised in a trial to negate the you know, operating a motor vehicle element. But my question is, you know, the defendant has, this wasn't a Norgard plea, the defendant is responsible for acknowledging that he committed the offense, you know, by operating a motor vehicle. Is operating going to be enough?
I think saying that you're, I'm having a hard time. I think if you're saying that you're driving, is that going to be enough to establish operating? I'm not sure, but it's not enough in this case, on the facts of this case.
So is it your argument that a defendant would have to come into court and acknowledge that they were volitionally operating a motor vehicle at the time of the accident? Is that what you're asking us to say?
I think it would need more than what we have here. It would need something like, I was steering, I was stepping on the gas, I was...
What about in cases where someone is so impaired? You know, I know here his position is that he had a seizure, but, you know, it could be a case where somebody's just really drunk and could come into court later on and say, well, I was so drunk, there couldn't possibly be a sufficient admission that I was volitionally operating the car. How is that any different than this?
Well, I think that falls under a different subdivision of the statute. There's the negligent operating under the influence.
Right, but in a case such as this, you know, where a person left the scene of an accident, for example, you know, the state's unable to establish that someone's drunk, what would prevent someone from coming back later and making the same sort of argument that's being made here, except for, you know, to a charge such as this, saying, I was so drunk, I couldn't possibly be volitionally operating the motor vehicle?
I think that, you know, the difference in that situation would be, I think what's important to focus on in this case here is bringing it back to the record and the record that we have in this case. And in this case, we have Mr. Brown entering a guilty plea, and the record itself has to show each of the elements of the offense. What the record would have to show in that hypothetical would be different, I think, than what the record has to show here. And here it has to show that Mr. Brown was operating, that he was doing a volitional act, and what the record showed is he had a seizure. The record showed that he was not conscious. He was not acting.
It was his choice to enter the plea of guilty. He takes all of that into account, and he says, I was in the driver's seat. I continued driving. I struck the person. When you're offering a plea, you're giving up any defenses that you might raise because of trial tactics and so on, and that's why I don't understand on the plea withdrawal. These were all great arguments to have if you're having a jury trial, but he gave up his right to a jury trial.
Your Honor, I think that parlays into the first issue here, his motion to withdraw his plea prior to sentencing, because it would have been fair and just to do so. He didn't get the statement from Ms. Johnson until after trial had started. They got the statement while they were picking the jury. He said, according to the record, he spent 30 minutes with his attorney discussing both her statement and the plea petition which wrongly stated which offense he was pleading guilty to. It said he was pleading to a criminal vehicular operation offense. When he got into court and entered the guilty plea, the prosecutor described it simply as a leaving the scene offense. It wasn't until the court itself described it as a homicide offense. That was the only point during the plea proceedings that happened. And it was after he got this statement from Ms. Johnson establishing with pretty clear evidence that he left the scene and didn't return that he made that decision to enter the guilty plea. But up until that point, he had been on a track to have a jury trial here. And I think that plays into why there was so much confusion, why his decision to plead guilty, he should have been allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, because it would have been fair and just to allow him to do so at that point, where there was all of these outstanding questions, where there were some issues for trial that weren't addressed, where he had this new evidence from Ms. Johnson, only discussed the case for 30 minutes, and the district court acknowledged that there was some confusion at the plea hearing over the offense, that it was stated differently multiple times. In denying his motion for pre-sentencing plea withdrawal under the fair and just standard, the district court misanalyzed it. The court acknowledged that the statute was confusing, but then focused its analysis on the difference between fleeing the scene homicides and driving under the influence homicides, where what Mr. Brown was confused about was that this was a homicide at all. He thought he was pleading guilty simply to leaving the scene, likely based on the statement that they received from Ms. Johnson shortly prior to him entering his guilty plea. And because this standard of fair and just is a lower standard than manifest injustice, he simply had to show a good reason for plea withdrawal. And here, he did that. And the district court erred in not allowing him to withdraw his plea at that point. There would have been very little prejudice to the state. As we just stated, the state was still gathering evidence. They had just gotten the statement from Ms. Johnson. There were police reports that would not have deteriorated in value. At that point, it would have been fair and just to allow him to withdraw his plea, especially over all of this confusion.
Why hadn't they got a report from Ms. Johnson at the time this happened, or did she just come back and watch and then leave without letting them know she was a witness?
I'm not exactly sure of the circumstances behind that, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me this whole thing gets muddled from the start, and that by not coming back, the police and the county aren't given an opportunity to properly investigate and charge this. It seems like a more appropriate charge here would have been that this guy knew he had a seizure disorder. He shouldn't be drinking. He shouldn't be driving if he's been drinking, or if he hasn't had a adequate period of seizure-free life to satisfy the return of his driver's license. Because if he had a seizure disorder, he should have reported that and should have lost his license. But there are all kinds of things they could have investigated and then charged it differently. It seems like the better charge would be, gross negligence for driving a car when you're likely to have a seizure.
Your Honor, I agree that there is a lot of unanswered questions about this case, and it is confusing, and that is exactly why he should have been allowed to withdraw his plea. They should have started this over. They should have done it correctly from the beginning. Why Ms. Johnson's statement was collected later, I don't know.
I understand from the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, that part of the plea offer that was consistently being made by the state was that they wouldn't charge Ms. Johnson with being an accessory after the fact or some criminal charge of her own if he ended up tendering his plea. So that, to me, indicates that there was awareness of what she had done or what she had said.
Certainly, and I would suggest they knew where she was. I mean, they went to the house where they lived together. They found the car that I believe belonged to her. It's not that she was out hiding. I don't know why the statement didn't come until right after jury selection had begun. I know that they needed to get an attorney for her to consult with prior to giving that statement.
It just baffles me that there were two people that knew this guy hit the victim, and neither of them told the police at the time it happened?
Well, I think Ms. Johnson went back to the scene, Your Honor.
I know, but there was this neighbor, too, that was aware of it, apparently. Neither of them let the police know that he was driving?
I'm not exactly sure what the police reports all indicate at this point.
Things in Minneapolis happen differently than they do out in the sticks, but my background's a stick, so...
The bottom line, Your Honors, is Mr. Brown is requesting to withdraw his plea in this case for multiple reasons. It would have been fair and just prior to sentencing. A manifest justice does exist here, and the plea is not accurate. Alternatively, the district court erred by not allowing him a dispositional or durational departure.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Emily Toms, appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent State of Minnesota under the supervision of Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras. A constitutionally valid plea must be accurate, meaning that there must be sufficient facts on the record to support a conclusion that the defendant's conduct falls within the charge for which he desires to plead guilty. The elements of this offense were previously mentioned by opposing counsel, but as a reminder, the elements of criminal vehicular homicide leaving the scene are the death of the victim caused by the defendant as a result of operating a motor vehicle, that the defendant knew that the collision involved injury to or the death of another, and the defendant failed to stop as close as possible to the scene and/or failed to give notice of the collision to law enforcement through the quickest means of communication. The sole challenge related to the accuracy of that factual basis is based on the definition of operating. That definition under State v. Henderson is that to operate a motor vehicle means to do any act that causes a motor vehicle to function or controls the functioning of a motor vehicle. I'd like to point to page 15 of the plea transcript where the appellant states under oath that his foot was on the gas pedal at the time that the collision occurred. That act is sufficient in order to meet the definition of operating, and therefore the plea is constitutionally valid.
Counsel, just a question. Say a person's driving down the road and they lose the ability to operate or be conscious because they have a diabetic coma reaction. The fact that their foot remains on the gas pedal, is that enough to say they're operating at the point that they're totally unconscious because of the coma?
I believe under the definition in Henderson, the answer is yes. And I believe in that situation, there may raise an additional elemental issue of knowledge. However, assuming that the individual comes to, learns of any subsequent collision or incident and acts on that, there may not be a problem based on...
That would be a defense they could offer if they go to a court or a jury trial.
I would agree, yes. I would also like to know, and I believe...
Counsel, though, yes. But you would agree that, and Judge Coggins did a really nice job here, but you would agree that neither he nor the attorneys specifically asked this defendant if he was operating at the moment so that he was in a convulsive state due to what he claims is a seizure.
I believe that's correct. The term operating during the factual basis did not exist, but...
Doesn't the plea record contain some information suggesting that he wasn't intentionally operating the motor vehicle at the time of the accident? And what are we to do with that?
I believe, you know, based on the factual basis, it does establish that he was having a seizure at the time. Therefore, the element of intent likely was not there. But I would argue, as I did in the state's brief, that act does not need to be intentional. The definition of operating says any act, not any intentional act, any willful act, simply says any act. And the requirement that in order to criminally punish actions, they must have been volitional. Here I would point to the volitional act in this case leading to criminal liability was his failure to return. That is the volitional act for which he was punished.
But operating a motor vehicle is still an element of the offense, right? So, I mean, we may care more about the fact that he left the scene of that accident, but the Constitution demands an admission in a guilty plea scenario to every element of the offense, right?
It does. And I would argue, you know, as was pointed out earlier, the factual basis establishes that he was driving. He was in the driver's seat, his foot was on the gas pedal. And I would argue that if we're comparing driving, which was the term that was used during the factual basis, and operating, I would argue that driving is a higher standard because it indicates full control of the vehicle. Whereas operating, under the definition in Henderson, says any act. And the facts of Henderson, it was in fact a passenger who reached over, yanked on the wheel, and in that moment caused a collision, where the Supreme Court clarified that the individual does not need to be sitting in the driver's seat. That is not the only individual that can be operating a motor vehicle under the definition.
I keep going back to the fact this is a plea that was made with the assistance of counsel, with the awareness that there may have been a defense, several defenses, that he chose not to raise. I mean, this was pending for over a year. So back how do you want to respond to the prejudice if this was allowed to be a plea withdrawal after it goes up to trial, the jury is there, and then he decides with full knowledge of all of these defenses that he wants to withdraw his plea? I mean, are you prejudiced or not?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that the state would have been prejudiced in two ways. The first one being the volatility of the passenger, who was a critical witness in the state's case. As the record reflects, the passenger was not able to be contacted by the state until jury selection had begun.
Passenger aside, he's aware of his own physical condition.
Correct. Correct.
Presumably.
Absolutely. And assuming, you know, had this gone to trial, he would have had the right to remain silent. Therefore, in terms of...
Was there any proffer of medical evidence that he was using in his defense when he was rejecting plea offers?
That is not in the record. And I believe that the prejudice to the state itself would have been in the volatility of that witness. The initial statement from the passenger was taken the day after the accident, and while the record is not entirely clear as to the specifics of that statement, we do know two things which are reflected in the supplemental statement given to the state directly right before trial, in that in the initial statement to the police, the passenger stated that the appellant had been under the influence of alcohol at the time of the collision. That piece of the statement was recanted immediately before trial, where the evidence of the seizure came for the very first time.
Well, you know, the other thing, when Scogin was listening to this, the plea withdrawal, I mean, he made comments to the effect that I've taken a lot of pleas. I don't know this judge, but apparently has done a lot of criminal cases, and his opinion was that that Mr. Brown was aware of what was going on. Now, was that when the motion to withdraw was being made?
I believe that that reference was Judge Scoggin placing his observations of the plea hearing and the appellant's demeanor and appearance of understanding at the plea hearing rather than at the plea withdrawal.
That was before sentencing then?
Correct.
Okay.
And to be clear, the accuracy issue was not raised until the appeal, right? That wasn't raised at sentencing.
Correct.
The counsel was the appellant in this case validly licensed to drive at the time of this event?
Your Honor, the record from what I saw is not clear on the status of his driver's license. I do know there are some statements during sentencing that at least one point his license had been revoked as inimical, or canceled rather, as inimical to public safety.
Okay. That suggests that it was either because of multiple DWIs or because of a seizure disorder. Because if you have a seizure disorder, you get your license canceled, not suspended or revoked. And it's canceled because you're inimical to public safety because of your medical condition until you prove you can go so long without seizure-free before the state will give you your license back.
I'm unaware of the specifics with the license cancellation, but that does appear to follow my understanding specifically in the DWI context. Your Honor, I would also like to just briefly note that, and this is probably most in relation to issue number one, the statements that alleging that appellant was seemingly surprised by this statement by the passenger, and that as a result of that, he had very little time to consider and prepare.
At what point?
Yes.
I didn't hear what you said.
No, my apologies. My apologies. Let me rephrase. So in appellant's principal brief, the one argument leading to the involuntariness was that the statement taken by the passenger immediately before trial began was disclosed very close to the start of trial, and that as a result, he did not have a chance to adequately prepare or understand, and things moved very quickly after that point between receiving the statement and entering the plea. And what I want to note is that the appellant lived with the person who gave that statement. This was not an anonymous witness who nobody was aware of, who had, nobody had any means of being in contact with. And I'm not arguing that the appellant had a duty himself to have gathered that statement, but the substance of that statement was likely known to the appellant because he lived with the passenger. And throughout voir dire, there was continuing conversations between counsel and the judge with appellant present that the state was trying to get in contact with the passenger because they had been unable to previously, successfully serve the subpoena. I also want to briefly address appellant's argument in the reply brief related to the penalty under section 169.09, just to say that under the facts that were given in the factual basis, appellant could not have been penalized under section 169.09, which is the standard leaving the scene section.
He wasn't charged with that.
Correct.
I mean, it wasn't in the charging instrument, so.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. The plea withdrawal motion indicates that appellant believed that he had pled guilty to a charge under section 169.09. And looking at the penalties prescribed, the subdivision 14 paren A of that statute provides a penalty for a driver who did not cause the collision when the collision results in death. Those are the factual situations that were put on the record during the factual basis. And so he could not have been punished under Section 169.09. Appellant cites to Subdivision 14 paren B, which relates to bodily injury and does provide a penalty for the driver who did not cause the collision. But here the factual basis clearly shows that it resulted in death and not merely bodily injury.
I want to be clear on the significance of the statements you just made. Are you suggesting that that goes to the reasonableness of his allegedly mistaken belief that he had pleaded to something other than a criminal vehicular homicide?
Yes.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Seeing no further questions from this court, the state respectfully requests that this court both affirm appellant's conviction and his sentence. Thank you.
Counsel, I had a question and now I forgot it, so maybe I shouldn't ask. But can I just reserve in case that
no.
comes up to ask her this later?
We have 1 minute. You want to think about it for a bit? We have 1 minute.
God, I'm 73 years old. It's hard to pull these things out of my hat sometimes. Okay. Would you agree, though, that the real damage to the state in this by the non-reporting is that they weren't able to probably properly investigate this?
Yes.
This death accident, and that really goes back to the defendant for not following through on his obligation to report?
I would agree with that, yes.
But how about as to that question of whether at the moment he struck this person, he was capable of operating anything? In other words, if he was in the throes of what I would guess would have been a myoclonic seizure, not a grand mal seizure, that he wouldn't have been able to do anything to control that vehicle or to talk or to be conscious. And if that's the case, then where does the factual basis come from as to that element of that requires operation at that moment?
I believe the factual basis, I see my time is...
If you can answer the
Thank
question.
You. I believe that the factual basis establishes, I've pointed to his own statement about his foot being on the gas.
Well, but does he know that at the time that he strikes this fellow? Because apparently he's unconscious at that point.
And there may very well be a lack of knowledge at that point. But the state's position is that the importance for knowledge is that the accident occurred and the failure.
What I'm trying to get at is my experience with these kind of cases, and I can remember four that involve situations like this. One was clearly an epileptic episode. Another was two were diabetic episodes. And the third that I'm thinking of may have been a diabetic sort of situation, or may have been a heart. Mm-hmm. But in all three, or all four, you had a situation where during the actual event, the person wasn't consciously aware and able to operate, and yet there was some other way to get the matter into court, mm-hmm. you know. But in the diabetic cases, no, there wasn't. They weren't charged with a crime in those cases. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with diabetic comas, but they can come on rather quickly. And a person loses consciousness, and if they've never had one before and they drive off the road and hit a guy mowing his lawn, you know, 50 yards off the road and kill him, you're probably not going to charge that case. I had that exact case when I was a prosecutor. That's why
sure.
I say that. So, I mean, it...
In those cases, would you consider that as being a viable defense and take that into consideration in your charging?
I believe so.
This was pending a year?
Correct.
Yeah, I understand. But the question is, regardless of when all this comes up, from the standpoint of a factual basis, if he's not acknowledging that he was operating the vehicle at the time it happened, and you don't prove it through someone else who can say he obviously knew what he was doing and operating, and apparently his lady friend isn't saying that's the case, how does the factual basis get established for that particular thing?
Your Honor, just focusing on the facts of this case, we have the factual basis that his foot was on the gas pedal at the time of the collision. And I believe that in this case, under these facts, that is sufficient. And I would agree with you that in an instance where a person has a medical incident, causes a collision, and remains at the scene so that the police can verify that that is indeed what happened and that the person did nothing wrong, that that likely would not result in prosecution. But that is not the case that we have here today.
All right, you're way over time, but thank you for your comments, and well, the last word, of course, goes to appellant counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to jump right to the factual basis with regards to this element of operating. Mr. Brown admitted in a leading question that he was driving the motor vehicle, but then he was asked in his own words what happened. In his own words, Mr. Brown said, "When I had the seizure, my foot was on the gas pedal, so it sped up. After the gentleman was struck, the car continued to drive, and it drove the two short blocks down to a cul-de-sac." Mr. Brown's foot was stuck on the gas pedal when he had the seizure, according to his own words.
Those are your words. I mean, we'll look at the transcript. We'll look at the plea, but you're trying to characterize it, and that will be for us to look at as far as
certainly,
the terms of the
plea. Your Honor, I'm just quoting from page 14 to 16 of the plea hearing transcripts, where he gives the statement in his own words of what happened there. And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter why his foot was on the pedal if he's unconscious. He wasn't volitionally putting his foot on the pedal any longer at that moment when he was having a seizure, when he was unconscious. And because he wasn't doing a volitional act, he could not have been operating the vehicle at the moment of that collision. A reflexive movement is not a subject to will. It is a reflex. And that is what happens when a person has a seizure. The record doesn't establish anything other than he was having a seizure at the time of the collision. And because of that, the record doesn't establish that he was operating the motor vehicle, regardless of, you know, what happened afterwards. That element of operating was not met here. And if this court has no further questions.
What was he looking at if he had continued with the trial and been convicted by the jury? What type of a sentence would he have received?
The 58 months was the bottom of the box sentence.
Okay. What was the top of the box?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
The range was up to 81, 58 to 81.
So he was saving 2 years, roughly, or almost 2 years, right?
Potentially.
Okay. So he had some motivation to take the agreement.
And he did argue for that departure, and part of our argument here is that there are substantial and compelling reasons to grant that departure based on his personal characteristics, which are all laid out in the brief there, his age, his you know, cooperative with the proceedings, the support he had, and his considerable remorse, but also the durational departure would have been appropriate here too, given the specific circumstances of this offense.
But again, that's for the trial judge to determine. We only determine if he carefully considered the arguments, not whether he had any obligation to depart.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is up to the district court's discretion, but in this case, the district court really focused on the fact that Mr. Brown did not come back and report the incident, and that was the focus of the district court's analysis. He didn't focus so much on the characteristics specifically of Mr. Brown. It was really bared more on the fact that he found that Mr. Brown should have returned to the scene. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Entner. And thank you also, Ms. Thompson and Mr. Petras, for appearing today. The arguments were very helpful. We will take the matter under advisement. A decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you for coming. That is the end of our oral argument calendar. This court is adjourned.
All rise.